Good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of State Government Budget Division for February 18, 2009. Today, I wanted to set aside some time to look at some alternatives on technology funding. We are aware that there's a lot of needs in state government. The most pressing ones within our division are the replacement of the MAP system and the integrated tax system within the Department of Revenue. The governor has made some proposals on the lease to own options, basically, where we spread out the purchase over a 10-year time period to purchase some of the technology for the state. I have had some conversations and meeting with some private vendors and also hearing from some basic information about the city of Minneapolis who've tried a different model where they basically, maybe outsourced some of their IT functions. And so I wanted the opportunity to hear a little bit more about that in this budget division, again, just to see what options are out there, there's any discussion points. So I do appreciate the folks who we have some folks who came in here from great distances to talk to us today. I appreciate you being here, and we appreciate the city of Minneapolis coming in here to give us a background of their experiences. So with that, I guess with Ms. Willenbring, are you from the – okay. Could you please identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lynn Willenbring. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the City of Minneapolis. Okay. And at your request, I come here today to talk to you a little bit about Minneapolis's story, what we decided to do to deal with some of the technology issues that we've been facing. And essentially, I titled this presentation Information Technology Sourcing, because I think every organization needs to look at specifically what their direct needs are and then decide what the sourcing solution is to best meet those needs. So just to give you a real high-level introductory into some basic sourcing options, you can source everything in-house. You can do some contract work where they can be either on-site or off-site. And then you can outsource or, as the more common lingo is, a managed service. And it really is a continuum. It's not necessarily an all-or-nothing situation. What Minneapolis decided to do back in 2002 was do a full information technology outsourcing, or ITO. So what you see here on slide 3 is the items that we have outsourced: our network, our data center, some of the activities with the data center that are covered under that, our service desk, and desk site support. Another somewhat unique aspect of what Minneapolis did was we also outsourced the asset ownership. So the city of Minneapolis no longer owns its desktops, its laptops, or its servers.
And Ms. Willenbring, I know you're going to get more deeper into it, but just as an overall view, you obviously have city employees who are doing their jobs and so forth, and you just have different people that have come in to run your servers, run some of these other things. Is that the overall concept where what you've done?
Mr. Chair, the only difference to what you said is that we actually sent everything off-site. So Our servers are housed in our service provider's data center. Okay. So the city of Minneapolis no longer owns or operates a data center.
Okay. And where are those servers located now, do you know?
Our servers are located in a data center in Eagan, Minnesota.
Okay, thank you. Okay, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Here is a listing of the retained organization, what Minneapolis kept in-house. And this is important because when people talk about outsourcing, it really isn't picking up the whole ball of wax and giving it to somebody else. A lot of organizations will do that if you have contracts on site, but there are certain aspects that really do need to be kept within the organization. For Minneapolis's purposes, we kept in support for all of our business applications. We kept project management and solution development in-house. However, both of those are done jointly with our service provider. Our enterprise information and content management, our telephony systems, and our quality assurance were all kept in-house. A piece that needed to be added was the governance. Because we now had a very robust relationship with our service provider, we needed to make sure we had the governance structure in place to manage that relationship and ensure that we were getting the service delivery that we needed and that we were moving the city forward. So when looking at why to outsource, there are probably 5 common reasons that organizations outsource. What I've listed here is those 5 reasons, but in the order that Minneapolis used them. Our primary purpose in outsourcing was so that we could focus on our core competencies. we recognized in our IT department that doing the break fix work was not where the city needed us to be. We really needed to be helping to move the city forward. And that was the second reason. We really wanted to accelerate the business transformation. We wanted to become strategic partners with the business units so that we could identify where technology could help improve efficiencies and effectiveness and not be worried about a mouse that doesn't work or a monitor that needs to be replaced or doing the backup on a server. We also wanted to improve performance. With a limited IT staff, we weren't able to have 24/7 service desks. We didn't have a disaster recovery site. We didn't have the consistency and reliability in the service delivery as far as when the servers were up, the network was operating. We wanted to improve that performance. We also had the desire to reduce costs, so that was not the primary motivator. At the end of the day, we actually looked at that as a fringe benefit. If we'd been able to outsource at the same exact cost, we still would have done it, but we did reduce our costs. And last but not least, access to advanced talent. When you go with a managed service provider that has a wealth of expertise, not just around the country but around the world, you don't have to bring on that staff and that added cost or bring in a outside contractor every time you need some expertise. You essentially have it available on demand. So as we decided to go down the implementation path, we did issue an RFP. We did enter contract negotiations. And we did engage our union. All of our IT staff was in a professional union similar to the state's MAPE. Professional Employees Union.
And Ms. Wallenberg, what time period did all this happen? How long ago was that?
Our initial contract was signed in December of 2002.
Okay.
And I do have another slide here that gets a little bit more detail for you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So I know one of the things the committee wanted to hear about was how we address the issues with the employees. So this is a slide that I actually just copied from a PowerPoint presentation that was done back in 2002 when Minneapolis made this decision. This is actually what was decided with the service provider during the contract negotiations. So they hired up to 20 of our staff. The employees had a first right of refusal, whether they actually went to the service provider or not. The position availability had to be in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, so nobody had to relocate. They were given a signing bonus of 10% of their annual base salary, but not to exceed $5,000. They had a 3-year employment guarantee, provided the performance was acceptable. Essentially, they were guaranteed they weren't going to be laid off. Their seniority from the city carried over to our service provider, and their benefits were fully vested based on the seniority that they were bringing over. So it was as if they had worked for the service provider for the same number of years that they worked for the city when they came in. What actually happened was we had 13 employees that transferred. 10 of those remain employed by the service provider today. 2 of them went and found other opportunities on their own, and one person was let go after about 4 to 5 years for some performance issues. But nobody was let go in that 3-year period.
Were there any other individuals that had worked for the city that wound up being out of a job entirely because they weren't hired by the provider?
Mr. Chair, no. Okay. Nobody was laid off as a result of this outsourcing.
Okay, thank you.
And as you requested, here is the timeline. Our initial 7-year outsourcing contract was signed in December of 2002. The data center migration was completed within a 5-month period of time. And then we did an independent midterm analysis. We actually hired a consultant to come in and evaluate whether we actually did prove out the business case that we made when we outsourced, as well as assessing the actual service delivery on that contract. With that analysis, what we found is that we had initially projected that we would save $20 million over the 7 years of that contract. We actually saved $18.2 million that they could validate. Doesn't mean that the other wasn't going to be saved. It's just they could, you know, come in and say, absolutely, we can assess that this has been saved. So, you know, a 10% swag seems like a pretty good estimate, given what we knew at the time. We also Well, I'll have it on the next slide, but we were also able to achieve some significant performance improvements. And in mid-2007, then, so 5.5 years into our contract, we took a look at whether we wanted to renegotiate or recompete when our contract expired at the end of 2009. What that analysis did, again, we had an independent third party come in and do that evaluation for us. They recommended that we enter renegotiations with the idea that if we weren't getting what we needed out of the new contract, none of it was throwaway work, we could simply go out for an RFP. We actually signed a new contract in December of 2007, a new 5-year contract. We essentially rewrote the contract because we now have some experience under our belt. We had best practices. We didn't have any outside consultants involved when we did this in 2002, so we didn't necessarily have the industry best standards in the contract. We now do. So when we did that midterm analysis in 2005, as I said, we validated $18.2 million of direct cost avoidance through the outsourcing. The overall process and performance increased. We actually had, by the analysis evaluation, a 30% improvement in our IT operational capabilities, so essentially our service delivery. And this is a direct quote from that analysis, that the city on its own could not have advanced to the current state within the same time frame had we not outsourced. Some examples of that are we put in a state-of-the-art computer-aided dispatch system for police, fire, and ambulance. We put in a 311 system in Minneapolis, the only city in the state that has that. We put in a new case management system for our city attorney's office that links in with the state and county court systems. And we're well on our way to deploying a large municipal wireless network. So since the question today is really, should Minnesota consider outsourcing, I would throw back to the committee, you know, are any of these things needed in state government today? You need focus on core competencies to accelerate business transformation, to improve performance, reduce costs, or access to advanced talent. If the answer to any of those is yes, then I strongly believe the state should consider outsourcing managed services and determine what best meets the state's needs. Essentially, the public sector has changed its focus. We're not so much about technology for technology's sake. We really are about information service delivery. The technology, in many ways, is some of the easier part. You know, I had the privilege of working for the state for 20 years in several different agencies. And what I saw during those years was that there is a great disparity between the haves and the have-nots. Some of the larger state agencies have incredibly well-run IT departments. They can advance things very easily. Some of the smaller agencies really struggle with just meeting the basic needs, and how are they going to be able to advance their organization and use technology to do that? And the reality in the world today is that these items, desktop services, help desk, web hosting, IT infrastructure, they really are commodity services today. That does not mean that the people working on them are a commodity and are disposable. It means that these are standard, repeatable processes that are commoditized in the marketplace today, and there are a host of organizations that can do these because that's all they do. And because that is their focus, they can do it far more effectively and efficiently and at cheaper cost than organizations that are just trying to devote a small part of their organization to doing it. You also have predictable technology costs and funding, a predictable service delivery, and Minneapolis achieved an annualized 12% IT operational cost savings, which we continue to see the benefits of today. You know, much of my time with the state was with the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue, in my estimation, has one of the best IT operations in the state. And I had the privilege of working with those people and understanding what they needed to do on a daily basis. And quite frankly, there's a wealth of talented people in the state that I believe their talents would be better put to moving the state forward, looking for those operational efficiencies, and not worrying about some of the break-fix things that they're required to deal with today. And I'd just like to close with a quote from President Obama. We cannot meet 21st century challenges with a 20th century bureaucracy. You know, the state has outsourced a lot of operations throughout the years. Information technology, I believe, should receive some serious consideration for that. Information services, delivering those services to the agencies and to the residents of this state and all the constituencies, that is where the state's core competency should be. With that, Mr. Chair, I stand ready for any and all questions.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Willenbring. I do have a couple of questions, and I'm sure the committee members will as well, too. I mean, ultimately, the city of Minneapolis had a choice of paying, you know, money to buy its technology, having its employees and so forth. You've decided to go with private vendors to provide it for you. I don't think they're doing it gratuitously. They're not doing it for free. So, I mean, overall, how are they getting paid for whatever they do, and what kind of arrangements does the city have with its contracts in so that you can realize the savings that you've identified?
Mr. Chair, committee members, essentially we have a contract that has I'm trying to think how to explain a 200-page contract quite simply. We have charges for our service towers, so our data center, our service desk, our network operations, our desk site support, and a lot of those are based on quantity. So if we reduce the number of computers in the environment, we reduce our costs. If we increase the number of computers in the environment, we increase our costs. Same things with mailboxes and servers. And so all of those things are factored in. What it gives us is some transparency and predictability in knowing whether we expand or contract, what's the financial result of that going to be. And as to your question as far as why can they do it cheaper, why is it cheaper for us to pay someone else to do this, let's just take a data center, for example. It costs a lot of money to build and operate and power a data center. To do a really good data center, you need a high degree of physical security. You need redundant power, which means you need power from more than one source coming into more than one point in the building. You need to have backup generators. You need to have a steady supply of fuel for those generators. All of those are very costly things. If the city of Minneapolis had to do that for itself, we could go broke. But with a service provider that does managed services like this, they can spread that cost over multiple clients. So we don't have to pay for our own generators. We're paying for a part of the generator that supports the data center where we and, you know, 30 other clients have their servers housed, the cooling, all those aspects of it.
I've got a couple of questions, and then we'll have other members talk as well, too. Obviously, if the city of Minneapolis decides it's not working out, you could terminate the contract just for the convenience of government, just as any government contract is. But clearly, you reach a point of no return, I think, when you start transitioning to this model where it's very difficult to reverse it and go back the way you used to do it. I'm sure there's a lot of discussion within the city saying, you know, at what point are we committed to the long term of this, and what if we find out we don't like it? I mean, what were some of the thoughts along those lines that you had?
Mr. Chair, committee members, there was a tremendous amount of discussion around that when we did the initial outsourcing. And what we realized with our first contract is we had some significant tails at contract termination, even if it was, you know, natural term termination, that we were not prepared to absorb. So when we did the second contract, we made some changes so that we minimized the tails. Quite frankly, the two biggest tails for the city of Minneapolis are the fact that we chose to have our service provider own the personal computers and the servers. Had we not chose to do that, and we chose that for some very specific funding reasons, that would eliminate a significant portion of the tail. The other tail that's really big for the city that kind of ties us into outsourcing for the long term, as you put it, is the fact that we no longer have a data center. We were leasing space from the county. The county was actually needed that space and was terminating our lease. So if we were to bring outsourcing back in-house today, we would need to find space for a data center, whether that meant building a new building or leasing space and building it out to a data center. Regardless of that, and that's a big cost right there, but as part of our budget deliberations for 2009 that we're undergoing right now because of the looming local government aid cuts, we have taken a look at the financial aspects of bringing it back in-house. And it just so happens that I have it here with me today. And essentially, if you put aside all those tail costs, it's still cheaper for us to continue to have someone else do the work for us. We save, forgetting all those operational costs, we're still saving probably close to $1 million a year. And that's on a total $26 million a year IT budget for the city.
Now, you've got one vendor, apparently, that provides all these services for you. And if I were to walk in Minneapolis City Hall and see a computer on somebody's desk, that computer belongs to the vendor, not to the city. Is that how it works then?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
If you switched vendors, the current vendor would probably come in and take the laptops away, and then some new vendor would come on in with new laptops. Is that how it would work?
Mr. Chair, that's potentially a way. Okay. There would be a potential that if we switched vendors, the new vendor could acquire the existing equipment. We could acquire it back and transition it. The asset ownership is something that in 2002 was quite prevalent in the industry. It's not so prevalent today. I think we're one of the few major outsourcing agreements that the asset ownership is with the managed service provider.
Now, data might be a huge issue because within private industry, of course, they've got their trade secrets and so forth, but government is unique because we can require people to provide information to us that they might not otherwise want to, but we can get it. And we store a lot of potentially private data within our computers. What kind of safeguards and systems do you have to make sure that only the people who have a need to know have access to it? Obviously, the people who are running the systems might have access to it, but you don't want to make sure that, it gets out into the wrong hands. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that there's been some time and consideration spent on those personal and very sensitive issues that you may have.
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely correct. And essentially, our security is better today than it was when it was in-house. And here's the reason why. First of all, we've got a Tier 3 data center. So it's very secure data center that our servers are housed in today. And as I'm sure you and the committee members are aware, the greatest risk to data is not from the physical access to the box, it's the logical access to the box. And that's where you're talking about firewalls and password protection, et cetera. All of the people that work on the City of Minneapolis servers that have access to those have been a full background checked by Minneapolis Police Department because we have much criminal data there and access to federal databases that requires that. So we actually have a better control who's in there, who's doing it than we had before. But essentially, you're looking at a lot of private sector organizations and other government organizations that do this very thing. And what I feel that I have today that we didn't have in the past is top-notch security people looking at our network and our systems every day that we just simply couldn't afford to do on our own. There's just too many systems, too few people.
How about employee compensation? You had those 13 employees who were employees of the City of Minneapolis, and they went over to the private vendor. Some are still with them, some are not. But obviously there's some changes to them. I mean, some of them have been working on, say, a pension, a government pension, which they may not be entitled to get after they go to work for a private vendor. There may be some compensation differences and so forth. This may be a little bit beyond, what you've gotten involved in because, they're now working for somebody else. But as far as, long-range benefits, employment, health care, and those sorts of things, was it in the employee's interest to be doing that? Were they better or worse off for having made the change?
Mr. Chair, I think the that question is best directed to the employees, but on the pay issue, just as the state struggles with paying, you know, at market rates in IT for compared with the private sector, the city has the same struggle. So essentially, the pay scale at a private sector organization is higher than for the same skill set at the city. So the employees would generally be better off that way. I'm not familiar enough with the retirement program, which is essentially a 401k, to make that evaluation. And, of course, with the market these days, who knows what anybody's is worth. But their time vested with the city would still be there. So they would still, if they were vested for retirement, they'd still have that defined benefits program with the city when they retired.
Okay. And again, Ms. Wollenbring is from the city of Minneapolis. She's just kind of giving us her experiences within the city on this one, and we're going to be hearing from some vendors and hearing about other states shortly. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wollenbring, when this was presented, the city of Minneapolis, as I remember, is a pretty union-oriented public employee employment base. Was there a pushback from the unions regarding this shift of outsourcing? How did that work?
Ms. Wollenbring.
Mr. Chair, committee members, yes, there certainly was a pushback. There's a great concern from the union as far as making sure that their members were protected. And you're right, Minneapolis is a very heavy union city as far as our staff, as well as the nature of our city council is very interested and supportive of the unions, which is one of the reasons, but not the only reason, why we engaged the union very early on. We have a union similar to MAPE, the state's MAPE union, for all of our professional IT staff. And they were engaged very early on what was going to make it palatable for them, what things would they be looking at to ensure that their members were as protected as they could be. And part of that was the fact that no employee was forced to take one of these other positions.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering, was it, now that it's established, would you say that there was a buy-in from the unions, or was it a kind of a hostile presence created with outsourcing?
Ms. Wollenbring.
Mr. Chair, Senator, hostile is probably too strong a word, but it wasn't an immediate buy-in. I'm not going to kid you that it was easy and everybody, you know, went skipping down the hallways. It took some time, and there are still some union members who are very opposed to it, but they are by far and away the voice of the minority, and a very quiet voice, quite frankly, because people generally see what the city has gained in our service delivery and our ability to manage costs.
And, Ms. Chair, in that regard, it's a good segue. You mentioned $18.2 million in cost avoidance. What's that $18.2 million of? Is there a percentage you could put it to, or a budget allocation before and after? There was an $18.2 cost avoidance, but what was $18.2 of?
Yes, sir. Remember, you were asking the whole state's city's budget and how much of this.
I don't know if it's the whole city's budget.
Yeah, if you could give us an idea of what the city's budget is and
some of the other things. Portion,
Sure. Yeah. Good question.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the 18.2, some of that, probably about $4 million of that was made up of the cost to outfit a data center, because that was a cost that we were going to have to incur.
Up front,
yes. Many of the costs were about asset purchase, whether you're talking about desktops, laptops. And then the other cost avoidance was things like disaster recovery. We did not have a separate disaster recovery site. We did not have a 24/7 service desk. 24/7 service desk, that you could argue is something that's, you know, discretionary, we didn't necessarily need. But disaster recovery site, that was something we needed. That was something we were going to have to do. And it's not just the one-time outfitting of the facility or the location. It's the constant care and feeding of that to ensure that that was operational when we needed it. So those are probably the three biggest areas, but there were more aspects that went into that 18.2.
And then, Mr. Chairman, one last question, and
that
would be on data privacy. We in the state who write the policies on data privacy, it's gotten to be a cult impression of what our focus is on it. And yet, at the same time, it's necessary. And Would that be the outsourcing contractor? Would they assume the liability of the privacy issue, or would that fall with the city, the liability?
And at least in
the case of the city of Minneapolis.
And let me add, we already have something in the Data Practices Act that if a private vendor is contracted to receive data from the government, they have to treat it and be just as liable as if it was a government entity, because there's penalties for wrongful disclosure. And so that's part of it. If there's this contract and a private vendor gets the data, we're going to treat them like as they were government if they violate the terms of the Data Practices Act. But Ms. Willenbring, you may have some other things that you've worked on within your area.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, you're absolutely correct. In addition to that, depending upon where the security breach occurred would depend on who's liable. So, I mean, if somebody stormed the data center and broke in, that would not be the city's liability. That would be the service provider's. As I mentioned before, your real risk is from the logical access to the data, and it's still the city's data. And so we still have the responsibility for safeguarding that data. And the box that the data resides on, the communication lines that it travels over, are only a piece of that.
Mr. Chair, on data privacy, we've even had what we thought was state-of-the-art protection on data in the state of Minnesota. Namely, I think the most recent breaches over recent contemporary time has been in the Department of Motor Vehicles, driver license data. I think that's about it. The legislative auditor did numerous reports during those weaknesses, and yet we keep getting assured that we have the best system and we will protect it. We're worthy of trust. And where does the city of Minneapolis, do they consider theirs to be as state-of-the-art as possible? Or 18.2 million seems like a large figure even for the city of Minneapolis, but do we get the bang for the buck and the protection for our citizens by looking at it? Or if we spend more money, absorb some of that 18.2, would you get a better system, a more secure system? How would you judge that?
Ms. Willenberg.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would never say publicly or privately that we have the best security ever, because it just challenges somebody to try and prove you wrong. I'm very comfortable with what we have. There is room for improvement. When I'm talking to, you know, for example, our city council members, and I can make everything as absolutely secure as possible, and I can guarantee nobody can get at it, including the workers that need access to the information. Your biggest risk with information security is human. You know, it's relatively easy to protect, you know, communication lines, the data center, the boxes, etc. But when you introduce humans into the equation is when things become a little trickier. So, yes, there's more the city could do. We could make sure that absolutely every piece of data that was stored anywhere was encrypted. We could use biometrics for all of our access to computers and facilities, for that matter, as well. There is always a balance between the right level of security and the right level of access so people can do the job, combined with the cost to do it. If you're looking at, you know, the CIA, you know, any of the federal alphabet soups that are dealing with highly sensitive data, their systems are going to be better than ours, no question about it. But they've got a lot more money that they can throw at it. And so, yes, we could spend more money and have even more security, but we have increased tremendously the amount of security that we have compared to what we had before we outsourced.
Mr. Chair,
Sarah Limmer,
one last question.
Sure.
Maybe you know, if there was a contract to outsource data, and if the legislature or the governing body would change its rules on data privacy, let's say getting more stringent, would the original contract between the government and the outsourcing service, would they be subject to change according to statute, or do all those contracts, do they all have to be rewritten as time goes on?
Well, I'd probably have want to defer to counsel, but my guess is that if the contract is properly written, it would say that the contractor would have to adhere to any future changes
subject
in the changes in the Data Practices Act. And Ms. Bodder,
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Willenberg.
Mr. Chair, regarding Minneapolis's contract, that's exactly what we have in there. So whether the state enacts a new law, the federal government, you know, if you start thinking of the Sarbanes-Oxley and, you know, SAS 70 and all the things that have come about in recent years, all of those are just automatically incorporated as they apply to the city of Minneapolis because those are new data security standards, they're new regulations that we must comply with. And so that's just a base setting in our contract that that needs to happen.
Any other questions of Ms. Willenbring about the city of Minneapolis's experience? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Willenbring, I'm wondering, when you were considering this, did you have more than one vendor to look at? So was there competitive quotes, or how did you arrive at your vendor? And do you have any confidence that if it goes back out for competitive bids that even though this vendor is well established, that other vendors might come in with bids to keep it competitive?
I suppose it's public record. What vendor do you have right now?
Mr. Chair, Senator, Unisys is our current managed services provider. And regarding your question, when we initially went out in 2002, we did do an RFP. And we did, I believe, had 8 respondents. We narrowed that down to 2, and Unisys was our ultimate selection. When we did this analysis in the fall of 2007, whether we should recompete or renegotiate, we did actually issue a request for qualifications, and I sent it out to about a dozen managed service providers and asked them that, given this criteria, would you be interested in competing for Minneapolis's business? And of the 12, there was probably 7 or 8 that said most definitely they would if we went out for an RFP again.
Any other questions? Anybody else? Questions of Ms. Willenbrink? Well, thank you. This has been very informative, and appreciate you taking the time to come down here today to talk to us about your experience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my pleasure.
Okay, thank you. As soon as she clears off, we'll have some representatives from IBM talking about experiences that other states have had in this area. So who is here for that? Hello, welcome to the Budget Division. We'll need to identify yourself for the record and particularly who you represent and where you're from.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're very pleased to be here. I am Teddy Wells. I'm a director within IBM's Public Sector Services Organization.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Whitfield, and I'm the general manager for IBM, responsible for our public sector, which includes all of state and local government.
Okay. Go ahead and proceed.
First of all, I would like to introduce you to IBM in Minnesota, just to give you a little history. We've been here since 1915, almost as long as our corporation is old. Additionally, we hire and have employed with us over 5,600 people in Minnesota. They're located in various different areas. Additionally, we also have 3,700 retirees, which continue to help the coffers of the state. Right now, our payroll in the state is almost $500 million, as well as the fact that IBM does sell to different organizations within the state over $1 billion worth of product a year and services. As IBM is a leader in technology, Minnesota is also. Out of our over 3,000 patents that we were awarded last year, 250 came from here, right here in Rochester, Minnesota. Additionally, we also have over 600 different companies that actually are in association with us as we help them sell their services along with our products. I'm very pleased to have seen the prior presentation. It really did explain very well what managed services is. Again, it is an outsourcing and/or the running of computer systems, information technology for someone else on the behalf of. Again, the key responsibilities were that the CIO did talk about are very important that they are retained. And a lot of that is around helping manage the services, setting the service levels such that we know what the targets are, what's acceptable or not, and making sure that the computers are up and running when necessary. Additionally, the policy has to be set then by the client as well as then looking at the different decisions that we make along the way. One other item that was brought up, again, is the employee transfer. Within the different opportunities that I've had and the different contracts that I've worked on for IBM with various state and local governments, we always bring those employees in. They come on board our company. They're provided a very nice career, even to the point of having opportunities for promotion and additionally education. They become long-term members of the corporation many times. So it is actually one of the best sources that we actually have of some of our very best people. Almost 50% of the employees within the IBM Corporation actually have become employees based on our different services contracts.
I actually happen to be one of the individuals. About 18 years ago, was working for another commercial entity and was informed that the position I was performing was going to be performed in the future by the IBM company. And at the time, looked at that as a great opportunity. And 18 years later, I'm still with the company, and it's worked out very well for me, and I believe it's worked out great for our company as well.
Okay.
Some of the recent or close in Minneapolis, Minnesota customers that we have that we do perform managed services with are Target, Best Buy, 3M, and Cargill, and many of them have been our customers in managed services for more than 10 years.
So before we move on to the next slide, just a couple comments here of what outsourcing is and what it isn't, because there's a variety of definitions that do circulate around. And I think Ms. Willenbring did an excellent job of explaining this from the client's perspective and was very accurate in her comments. Outsourcing can be done in a number of different ways. Outsourcing can be done, and it is a continuum as was described earlier, but it can be done by a vendor. And depending on the requirements of the client, it can be done in multiple different ways. Some of our clients like to take advantage of the global reach of service providers and would authorize the work to be done from anywhere around the globe. Some of our clients like the work to be done from within the borders of the United States, which is pretty typical in state and local government. And some of our state government clients actually require the work to be done from within the borders of their own state in its entirety. And IBM, as well as other service providers in the industry, are capable of handling that on any continuum the client might like to choose. So, you know, outsourcing and offshoring oftentimes are confused. Those are two very different things. I'm going to use the next slide, if I could, Teddy. Mr. Chairman, you had suggested or asked earlier about how can a service provider do this and make a profit and still save a client money. This chart, I think, helps to depict that. And if you look at the line going up from left to right, that's kind of the curve of a typical client's IT spend or cost. It's labeled on this chart as projected cost. You see it does increase slightly over time. That's typically associated with the cost of labor and software, because the cost of hardware typically comes down as performance improvements are attained by vendors that manufacture that type of product. But in the aggregate, the cost of running an IT infrastructure typically does go up over time. A lot of our state government clients have been underfunded in the area of IT. And to get themselves up to the level of specificity to be able to take advantage of some of the newer technologies and approaches to managing services, it takes a fairly substantial investment. That's the purpose of the bubble here on the chart. That bubble in a non-managed service environment falls to the expense of the client, and it would be their budget that would be affected by that. In a managed services environment, that bubble is usually absorbed by the vendor. And it could take, you know, upwards of $50 to $70 million in many of our client environments that we go into in order to get them to the level of specificity, in order for them to take advantage of some of the things that the city of Minneapolis has taken advantage of now, as are many of our other clients. Once we come over the top of that bubble and make those investments, we can drive through efficiencies, and I'll give you two examples in a moment, to take the cost lower over time, which is where you typically, as a service provider, are able to earn a profit. Okay, so it takes pretty significant investment up front. As a commercial entity, we can typically put those items onto our balance sheet and then amortize them and link them with the period of time where we actually recognize the revenue associated with it, so it doesn't look like a bubble like it does here for most commercial entities. So two examples of how that happens, and I'll use desk-side support as one example, because I think most people have access to or use personal computers. The personal computer that someone is using at some point is likely to break. When it breaks in most of our clients' environments before they move to a managed services relationship. There is a technician that is dispatched, or immediately there's usually a call or someone's asked to go fix that piece of equipment. Oftentimes includes travel time to get to and from a location, may or may not have the right parts to do it. The equipment may be at the end of life and needs to be replaced. You can't oftentimes figure that out until you arrive. So there's great inefficiency in the process. As part of that bubble that you're seeing on the slide, what most managed services providers will do is make a fairly significant investment not only in the equipment itself, so refreshing the personal computers at a more frequent basis. On average, their lifespan is usually 3 to 4 years. We oftentimes find clients using them 5, 6, or even 7 years out. But when you have equipment that's of that age, you can install the tools on it that are necessary to get efficient. So you need to spend the money, make the investment, upgrade the equipment, and then you can install tools on to the PC, and you can actually diagnose the problem and correct the problem remotely from a center someplace else. So there's no more dispatch of someone going out. Someone can actually handle that without leaving. So you can cover a much broader set of pieces of equipment with fewer individuals doing it, and that can actually take some of the cost down. The other good example, and I know it's a situation that that you deal with here in the state of Minnesota, is a distributed set of data centers. And that becomes very inefficient very quickly, as our previous speaker mentioned, that if you have a distributed set of data centers, you're worrying about cooling, which is a big issue in data centers. This equipment runs very hot, and it needs to be kept at moderate temperatures, or else it will fail. So you have all sorts of environmentals, including the power coming in, the cooling, and the communications lines that are coming in, usually from multiple sources, to make sure a single fiber cut wouldn't wipe out your data center. And you have that in multiple places, or you don't have it. So either you have the risk associated with not having it, or you have the cost associated with having it. If you can get into a consolidated data center, you can do it typically with less equipment, less floor space, less power consumption, and therefore significantly lower cost. And those are two examples of how a service provider can drive down the cost. Now, a simple argument would be, or point would be, a client could do that themselves too. And the answer is they absolutely can. If they have the funds to invest and they have the skills necessary, they can do it. Most of our clients we find don't have the skills necessary to do this kind of transformation, nor do they have the funding necessary to handle that upfront $50 to $70 million that it sometimes costs to make the investment to get up to the level of specificity to be able to take advantage of what the technology can bring.
Before I get too much further, I notice at the bottom of the page it says confidential. You do realize this is a public hearing, right?
Yeah, we can remove the confidential notation.
Okay, because anything you've handed out is not confidential.
Yeah, and we understand that.
We underway.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Ready? Advance, please.
Yes.
All right. So the sole purpose of us being here today is to share with you best practices of what we've seen. We're not attempting to influence any decision of the state. We certainly have a point of view on this and how it works effectively for our clients. But what we wanted to do in this section is take you through what other state governments have done and allow you to have that information as you make decisions as to what's most appropriate here in Minnesota. So we've laid out a number of clients that have made the decision. I put them in chronological order from which they made the decision to outsource, and they stem back as far as the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania that went through this back in the late 90s. So in 1998-99, even a little bit before that, the Commonwealth was preparing themselves by consolidating under a single statewide CIO and then decided in order to get the true benefits of consolidation that they were going to use a managed services provider. They made that decision in 98-99 and went into an implementation. The best practices that came out of Pennsylvania, and the reason that it's very relevant here, is that it's the longest standing relationship. So they did this 10 years ago. They've extended the agreement with the current provider twice since then and have seen great value from that relationship. When they did this, they started with a study, which is, I understand, something similar that the state of Minnesota is either doing or considering. They leveraged consultants, which Ms. Wollenbring also suggested that the city of Minneapolis didn't do that the first time and then chose to the second time around. And then they used a process to narrow down the number of vendors but keep enough vendors in that they could get a good broad set of points of view. And they do that through either an RFI, which is simply to put out a request for information and have vendors come back and say this is what we would be able to do or would be willing to consider doing for the state. or an RFQ, which is a qualification, which says we'd like you to submit your qualifications as to why you think as an entity or as a team or a consortium you have the ability to perform the type of services that we're requesting, and then narrow down the number of potential vendors that you would send out an RFP to. And the advantage that each of these clients has done some form of this, and I'll talk through them. The advantage that brings is you don't have to deal with 20 responses. I don't think anyone would want to have to go through 20 responses of some several hundred pages each, but you can actually narrow the field down to a logical handful and then be able to get best input from each of them and then make your decision. And that's what they did in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and as I indicated, they've had great success in that relationship. The state of California was kind of the next to go in an ambitious way. This is instead of an enterprise-wide IT infrastructure program, it was for a single agency, happened to be a very large agency, that's responsible for their child support enforcement program. The state had had a previous failed procurement, so they'd attempted to do this before, and before the contract was initiated, the relationship was terminated for a variety of reasons. They came back out to the market a couple of years later, put out a subsequent request for proposals, and then entered into an agreement in 2003. And this one's kind of the glowing example of the greatest success in cooperation between state government and a vendor in the IT area. This took a system that was not a statewide system. The state of California was receiving massive penalties from the federal government for not having the system certified. And they set out an ambitious five-year plan to get that system certified. And in December of 2008, on schedule and within budget, I might add, they achieved that certification. And their process was an excellent process of identifying what their specific goals were. And they've probably done the best I've seen of that in advance of putting out the RFP and then driving the vendor community towards a solution that would meet those goals and then effectively managing it over a very long period of time. 5 years is a long period of time. But that's exactly what they did, and they managed it quite well in conjunction with their vendor to be able to achieve that success. The next was the Commonwealth of Virginia, who used an entirely different approach. They actually asked the market to provide unsolicited proposals. So they didn't put out an RFP. They just said to a variety of vendors, we'd like you to tell us what you think you might be able to do for us here in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And then they distilled that information down to a handful of vendors and then asked for actual submissions. They, too, used a consultant. They, too, used a study. And those are common best practices that we do see across the industry. Is the study allows you to understand yourself first. You really need to understand what you have before you can ask someone else to consider managing it on your behalf. And then bringing in a consultant brought in extensive industry knowledge to make sure that there was a good counterbalance to the knowledge that the vendor community has. Now, we've built up massive amounts of awareness of what works and what doesn't work in these types of programs over the years, and it's nice to have consultants supporting clients to help counterbalance that that knowledge chasm that sometimes does exist. Texas was next. They decided to outsource their data center services. So this is IT infrastructure for their mainframe and their mid-range, which was a less ambitious program than the Commonwealth of Virginia, which was an entire enterprise-wide initiative, which included their desktop services, their network, their call centers, their help desk, their data center, and it was a very comprehensive initiative. In Texas, they limited it initially to do data center services, which is what we refer to as a mainframe and a mid-range environment. So it's high-end servers and mainframe processing first, and then they're assessing how they land on that, and then they'll decide how they want to proceed. They, too, used a similar approach that we've seen as a best practice, that is, do a study, understand exactly where you are today, know what the challenges are, bring in a consultant to lead establishing an RFP, and then evaluating the respective bidders, and then making a decision. And then the most recent was the state of Georgia, which just announced an award of a contract in November of last year. And their program is a little bit broader than what Texas is doing. So it's also the mid-range and mainframe environment, which is high-end computing, but it also includes end-user computing devices, PCs, and things along those lines. What Georgia did that I would call out as a best practice is they did probably the best job I've seen of establishing themselves for success by creating an organization within the Georgia Technology Authority, which you have an analog organization here in the OET. to establish their capabilities and make sure that they would have the right staffing in place to be able to manage and monitor a relationship that they were going to establish with a vendor. And they did that through a mix of internal skills they had, and they actually did some external hiring of people that had worked in a commercial environment in the past and had been clients during an outsourcing engagement. And that mix of internal versus external really has served them well in preparing themselves for success in that relationship.
Before we go on, we always like to hear about the best case scenarios and the success stories, but we also need to know about the worst case scenarios and the failures. Have there any, are you aware of any states, either the ones that you've had here, who ventured into this and regretted it or had to make some changes or things that just didn't quite work out the well that as they thought it was going to?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent question.
Okay.
The answer is there are some of those, and I would tell you none of these go smoothly at first. You're making what I would refer to as disruptive change, going from an IT environment that typically is aged and decaying to something new, and that does create disruption. I would say there's a lot more risk in the items that you just mentioned if you're focused on an application, development of an application or a new system or set of services. If you're managing the IT infrastructure, most vendors are quite capable of being able to handle that without too much disruption. Now, having said that, would I tell you that things are going perfect everywhere we've done this? Absolutely not the case. But I don't recall seeing an IT infrastructure outsourcing initiative be reversed. On the application side, I've seen contracts terminated or massive undertakings that included rewrites or redevelopment of systems and processes that have been terminated by clients and reversed back. But I've not seen one in the infrastructure side.
But by the way, the noise usually comes if there's somebody's got a BlackBerry that's too close to the microphone that causes some interference. So if anybody's got a BlackBerry close to a mic, turn it off or move it away. Any questions on this part of it? Okay, go ahead, proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. All right, Teddy, can you answer for us, please?
Yes, observations and issues. Some of the different items that we've seen as we have worked with the different states and even brought our private sector experience in is one that Minnesota is facing now where you've got many data centers. I believe the number totally could be up to about 52, and not all of them are used well, such that there's empty space that's not being used when someone else doesn't have enough space. So we actually look at when you're consolidating or going into managed services to take that space, put it together in an effective and efficient use such that you can actually return back to the agencies normally most of that data center space, if not almost all of it. Additionally, on all the different computers that you're running, the servers and things, especially in a federal funding environment, there are excess cycles on machines, we like to call it white space, or even excess space on disk drives that aren't being used across different agencies or even across many times in an agency across some of the different departments within it. So that you're not utilizing it to its best advantage. You may have things that are left standing and idle when they could be used by another organization. Additionally, as Brian has already talked about, the age of the equipment. It's not unusual for us to see aged equipment. Some of it is because of the fact that you've got to have capital bonds, most likely, on an ongoing basis in order to refresh, and it becomes difficult, especially in times such as we're facing today. Disaster recovery is something that is very, very close to our heart, as well as I know from every government body. One of the customers that we also have within IBM is actually the IRS. And some of that data is very important to us, not only from a disaster recovery background, but from the security standpoint also. So the different methods that we put in place for security, whether it's encryption as well as physical security, are very important, and we use those learned lessons in our state and local government as well as our private sector. Many of the states that we've been with, they don't have consistent disaster recovery available for the different applications or the government programs across different agencies. Some may be very protected, and others are basically hoping that it doesn't happen. We've even had experiences where data center managers actually take tapes of data home with them because they don't know what else to do with them, but they know that they've got to have it available so that they could use it. Those are some of the areas where we put in high-tested, reliable centers, as well as the processes in order to make the recovery of systems, many times within even a 4 to 24-hour basis. You want to talk about some of the tools?
Sure. I'll take this from here, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
As far as tools being deployed into the environment, one of the things we oftentimes see in state government is agencies run their IT organizations, and I know you've made good strides here in the state of Minnesota through the OET to try to get to some level of standardization. But until that equipment is actually brought into a consolidated environment and brought up to the level of standard where you can use a common set of tools, you really can't get the efficiency that you might if you're in a consolidated environment. And what I mean by that is you can actually deploy monitors out into the systems. You can actually see the performance of the equipment across the entire enterprise, and when that's really done well, you can actually reprovision capacity on an on-demand basis. So if there's a particular application in a particular agency that's running at a high level of utilization, and we're seeing that unfortunately right now in a lot of unemployment systems across the United States right now, you can actually reprovision some capacity to help absorb and adjust to that change. And that's why the importance of tools. We talked a little bit earlier about space. If you can reduce space and use less raised floor, we call it raised floor. The equipment sits on top of a platform, so you can run the wires and other things underneath it. It makes it much more efficient and cleaner. Also keeps the equipment protected. If there's somehow ever were a leak, the water can stay underneath there, and it's less damaging than if it gets in the equipment. But that raised floor is oftentimes very expensive to maintain because of the cooling and the environmentals that you need to concern yourself with. And reducing the footprint of the equipment is pretty significant. You do that through a number of ways. You can reduce the number of pieces of equipment that you have, which we oftentimes see in our client environments can be reduced by, you know, sometimes 30 to 40%, the number of actual servers. And the newer technology tends to be much smaller, and you can use less floor space that way. They tend to use newer equipment, uses less electricity, and therefore requires less cooling, and actually can save on your power consumption pretty significantly as well. And then the other thing we see that is oftentimes missed is the total cost of ownership view. And what I mean by that is there is a point in time with a piece of equipment that it will actually cost more to maintain than it would to replace, much like any other long-term asset that any of us use, either our vehicles or in our houses. At some point, it doesn't make sense to have someone come in and repair something again. It makes more sense to replace it. And through the consistency of a managed services relationship, that obligation is on the vendor to provide a certain refresh schedule as agreed to in the contract. And it actually helps raise the level of service for everybody involved. And I think Teddy already touched on the federal funding aspect of it.
Yes.
I'll talk briefly about this one. I don't know how well you can see this, but this is actually in an environment of one of our clients that we're in the process of transforming. I could best describe this as to what happens behind most of our TV sets if we continue to connect different appliances to our TV without properly managing the wires that sit back there. The reason I show it to you is that this is pretty prevalent throughout most of our clients to see an environment like this. This is not what you would see in a world-class data center. You wouldn't see these wires. They'd be tied off. You'd be able to go in and see where everything was connected or should be connected. And the issue here is, as a technician showing up, when a server is not functioning properly, the first thing you're going to do is what's known as rebooting that server, which is a complex way of saying we're going to turn it off, then turn it back on, and hope that it works. Sometimes that actually fixes the problem. When it doesn't, you need to start chasing wires to make sure your connections are right. And if someone shows up at this particular location to do that, I suspect they're probably going to be there for a while and may bump into some other things they don't want to touch while they're there. And it makes it very difficult. But this is something we see, you know, 20 plus times across a lot of states that they have. And this is mission critical data sitting on these pieces of equipment that is not in a secure environment and in this case, not connected properly and probably not going to function very well. We actually had one client share a story with us that someone actually had come in and taken one of these boxes out of one of their centers. So, and we talk about the logical access to data and the risk of security. Someone actually picked one of these up as they get smaller with the advances of technology and took it home with them. And that's a problem. So it really needs to be in a better environment than this, and that's what most managed service providers will bring to you. Okay, so we'll move on to solutions. We've talked about a couple of things here already. Getting to a standard level of service is very important. So oftentimes we find in our state government clients that they don't measure the level of service that they're getting today across the enterprise or even at the agency level. The reason for that is it's actually quite expensive to install the tools to measure performance. And if you're going to do it in a very small for a very small group of pieces of equipment, it's typically not cost-effective. As a service provider, we're using those tools all around the globe and can take advantage of economies of scale. So we can give much better visibility into how the environment is running. We are willing, and all service providers are, to sign up for penalties associated with not hitting the service levels that are required by the contract. So if you're not getting the level of service that the contract says you're supposed to get, then the service provider bears a financial burden associated with that. And I will share with you that's painful and causes us to very swiftly fix those issues so they won't end up with another penalty. Better tools, I've already spent enough time on that, but being able to diagnose what issues are and sometimes read in advance to find out where problems are going to occur. We can watch spikes on a particular piece of equipment, and we know when it's reaching its capacity and can provision additional capacity to that piece of equipment before an outage occurs. That's a major part of a managed services relationship that most of our clients today don't see the benefit of. Having more reliable hardware and an upgrade schedule, knowing that that equipment will always be at constant levels of some level of currency, usually one or two revisions back is a pretty comfortable place to be. That's a cost-effective way to manage the environment and keep it up to a level of specificity that allows you to take advantage of the tools. We talked about data. Data encryption is a very popular thing these days. We don't see many of our state government clients having the ability to encrypt data. A, it's very expensive. And B, most of the tape media that's out there that houses quite a bit of this data is too old and doesn't allow encryption. And we do find quite a bit of that in our state government clients. And that needs to be raised to a level that does accept encryption so that we can properly protect that data. And then, of course, Teddy mentioned disaster recovery, where it's not uncommon for critical applications to not be backed up at all. And when, you know, when budget cuts often come to the IT environment, one of the easiest things, I think, to cut is disaster recovery, because you don't feel it unless you have a disaster, and then you really feel it. So it's an area that does get underinvested in pretty easily, and I suspect you probably have some of that here in the state. We do see it in our state government clients pretty pervasively. And then a comprehensive inventory and asset management checking capability, knowing where your assets are and the age of them and the use of that equipment. We find oftentimes software sitting in boxes, licenser being paid for, and no one's using the software. Not uncommon at all to find that in commercial as well as government environments. Someone bought software near the end of a fiscal year or near the end of a quarter because they needed to or they thought they could get a great deal on it, and then it doesn't get it put into the production environment, and those licenses are paid for, including maintenance on it, for something that's sitting on a shelf. We obviously look to wring that out of the environment as well. And then an enterprise billing system that actually lets you put accountability where the accountability is. There are older applications that tend to use a massive amount of processing capability and network time, talking back and forth between pieces of equipment. You'll identify that through a managed services relationship and can probably root some of that out and make the changes in the environment necessary to get that cost down. Or if someone is required to have that level of interaction or cost, then they'll be the one paying for it. And a lot of times we see that's new news to our clients as to how much some of these things actually cost to run. So we'll summarize here, and again, I'll take a half step back and say that I think you're heading in the right direction. You've made some of the first logical steps that make sense to better protect your IT environment and to save cost. Assessing the environment was the first step, I believe, you took. Establishing the OET was obviously critical in having that study conducted. But in the end, this decision is entirely up to the folks in the state of Minnesota. And you get to decide whether this makes sense for you or not. And the value of gathering information like you're doing today, I think, is a very smart thing to do, which would be very helpful to you in making that decision. But in the end, how you proceed is your decision. I don't think the decision to consolidate is one that you should consider optional. It's something that I think, as a state, you really need to do to protect the interest of your citizens, the cost associated with managing your IT environment, and protecting the data. Now, how you go about that, whether you do it internally or externally, that's really where the decision comes in. But I would encourage you to stay on the path that you're on now to consolidate and get yourselves into a better environment.
Could you clarify what you meant there? I mean, when you say consolidating what? I mean, keeping OET separate from the other functions? I mean, I'm not
yes,
sure.
So, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. I'll be glad to clarify that for you. Consolidate means get the 52 data centers you have today down to one or two. And that can be done, you know, through leveraging the OET, or it can be done through leveraging the OET with assistance from a managed services provider. Either of those two methods are available to you. But the consolidation is really get the equipment into a better place where it's better protected, and it costs you a whole lot less to run, and you can manage it more efficiently. That's what I mean by consolidated.
Thank you. Okay. We do have a couple of questions. We'll get to members and members. Please proceed.
I'll wrap up here in about 30 seconds.
Sure.
If you do decide to go down the path of managed services, the study findings will be critical to you. Understanding what that study says and what it's recommending, I think, will be very important to you. Then you kind of have a decision checkpoint. Do we want to look at this internal or external? And you kind of need to make that decision early on in the process. If you want to keep this internal, that's a different set of things that you would likely go through next than if you wanted to do it with the support of a vendor that can provide managed services. If you do go outside, I would strongly encourage that you consider using a consultant. The consultant needs to be independent of any of the service providers that may bid on the contract. I think that's a very smart thing to do. They will help you and steer you through the process and make sure you're getting good comparisons across the various vendors. Technology tends to be quite complex, and unless you live in that world every day, it's something where you might want to get some expertise from a consultant, so we recommend that. The RFQ, or qualification process, or RFI, requesting information process, are good lead-ins to get to an RFP. If you're going down that path, it will help you limit the number of vendors that you actually would work with for an RFP and have an understanding of their capabilities first. I think that's valuable. And then the last thing is build the support structure internally to be able to handle the extra work, because this is not an easy undertaking. Those that have done it from the client side of the equation would readily tell you that it's a massive undertaking. It takes a tremendous amount of work. It can distract people from their daily activities of managing your IT environment, so it's good to separate the folks that are working on an RFP from those that are actually managing the environment. And I would encourage you to spend some time with your peers around the country, or the OET's peers around the country that have done this, to understand what the impact was on them and how they managed through it. And with that, we conclude our prepared comments.
We do have a number of questions. You know, I mean, computers are involved in everything the state does. We have some specific computer applications just within this division, the MAP system, that's the procurement system for the state, trying to integrate the tax collection systems from a number of computer systems into one. We've got, you know, an agency as large as the Department of Human Services. We've got two-person boards out there. We've got computers all over the state to the Department of Natural Resources. I mean, whatever we do, we got to make sure that they work and that the systems can talk to each other from one agency. They can talk up to the federal government and down to the counties, the townships, the citizens of the state, and so forth. So I don't think there's any one solution in here, but we're trying to figure out what the options are. Senator Rest, do you have some questions?
No,
okay. Senator Jungbauer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had two questions. The one that I guess really piqued my interest is in terms of security. That's one of the issues that we're constantly worried about here, and as we move to more and more online licensing and things like that, is you know, hackers, somebody getting into our system. How does an outside vendor, how are we covered as a state in terms of liability if we use an outside vendor for our services?
Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Mr. Whitfield.
Thank you. There's a couple ways to do that. I'm going to give you a technological answer, then I'll give you a liability answer, if that's okay. Okay. From a technological perspective, it is important to get that data encrypted. If it's critical data and it's, you know, personally identifiable information or any other HIPAA or any other data that you might be concerned with, it's important to get it encrypted. And that will reduce the risk. If someone were to take a piece of encrypted equipment, the chances of them getting anything out of it is very close to zero these days, because the encryption is so good. If it's not encrypted, on the other hand, the chances are pretty good they will get something out of it, and that's unfortunate. So the answer from a technological perspective is to avoid where the risks are, and the risks are not having data encrypted, and the risks are in the physical human transfer of that data. So you take a tape out of a machine. As Teddy mentioned, we had one client that people were putting these tapes in the back of their vehicle and driving them to their home and parking them in their garage. And I would suggest that's not the level of security that we might like to have for for important data. So it's getting the processes straightened out. So there's a technological aspect of it, of the encryption, the process aspect of it, of making sure you've got those things scanned in and out of a building anytime they go out. Everyone knows exactly where they are. They know where they're going. They know what the destination is. They know when they're supposed to get there. And someone's checking to make sure that they arrived on time, and you're using a reputable firm to move them back and forth. From a liability perspective, you weave that into the agreement with the vendor. And you know, vendors are willing to sign up for a certain level of liability. If it gets to be too high of a level of liability, you'll price them out of the market. So there is some level of shared acknowledgement of risk. But vendors typically, and I think I can say this on a kind of across the board basis, are much more willing to take that liability if the data is encrypted. So back to the technology answer, you get it encrypted. Vendors will take high risk on that because they know there's very little that can be done with it. If it's not encrypted, and it's not encrypted because you've not asked for it to be encrypted, or you didn't have the funds available to get it encrypted, or you couldn't get to the level of specificity and tape drive that allowed encryption, then I suggest vendors would be a little bit more resistant to take a very high level of liability. They'll still take liability, but it's typically a much lesser level.
So, Drinkbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question. When we really get into things, is there a way to break down and get examples of cost savings or benefits and savings so we can, are we going to be able to, as we move through this process, really get some tools so we know a good comparison on what it'll potentially save us in terms of costs or the benefits so we can weigh that all out?
Right. Mr. Chairman, Senator. The answer is absolutely, and this gets back to my recommendation of a consultant. One of the things a consultant will do is they'll establish what's known widely in the industry as a base case, and that's the best estimate they can do of what you're spending on your IT infrastructure today. And then you put out an RFP. If this is, in fact, the direction you go, vendors will respond to that knowing what your specifications and your requirements are, and they'll give you a price. And then you can compare that price to your base case and determine whether you're getting savings. And since the base case is usually done by an independent consultant, you get a very good view of it. Now, I will tell you, in state government, it's sometimes difficult because not all states charge for floor space. They're not all states, I have found, charge for electricity at the local level. And so some adjustments need to be made to that base case to so-called normalize it. But you can actually see the base spending of what you have on IT today and what the price will be from a vendor. And back to that slide that I showed with the bubble, when we get efficient, we can actually bring the cost down pretty significantly, and you should see savings. Our clients typically see, in a state the size of Minnesota, I'm guessing because I don't know the environment here that well yet, but it's over a 5-7 year period, it's not uncommon to save 10-15%, which gets into the hundreds of millions of dollars based on the size budgets that we're talking about.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Thank you. I also want to talk about, and as Brian was talking about the base case, if you use a consultant, is really granular. It's going to talk to you about it costs us this much to mount a tape. It costs us this much to run a CPU cycle. So you can really get down to a granular level in order to then later be able to compare back to did we save or not. So it really is a granular look at your current spending, as well as then allows you to prepare for the future.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the IBM representatives? If not, thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you very
so
much.
So far, we've been kind of focusing on the policy and how the technical aspect, but obviously this is the budget division. So we have to figure out, does this make sense from a budget standpoint? And we do have somebody here who's going to talk about the funding alternatives and see what may or may not be available for us. So do we have somebody here? Come on forward. Welcome to the budget division. Please identify yourself for the record. And we have a book, three-ring binder here. I guess it's going to have your presentation in.
That's right. Thank you. This Mr. Chairman and committee members, and pleased to be here today and share some information that I hope you find helpful in your process and deliberations. And my name is Steve Dahl. I'm with Deloitte Consulting out of our Minneapolis, Minnesota office here local. I live in Roseville, Minnesota, and very pleased to be here and talk to you about some different options. I would like to describe for you what I have in the packet for you as a committee. I have a brief presentation that just describes some of the key options to consider that a number of states have effectively used when you're looking at how do you fund major IT initiatives when you're in a time where you don't have general fund dollars available? How do you keep that innovation going? What are some options? So that's the first few pages. I'm going to walk through those items here in the next few minutes. Back behind that is really some reference material that is a really good source, set of source documents that provides some additional detailed examples around those different options. First one being a document pulled together by OET last year on funding alternatives, and the two behind that being the both the 2003 and the 2008 National Association of State CIO innovative funding option surveys that have been done. And would point to if you read through that or your staffs read through it, certainly one thing I think is of good interest to look at between the 2003 and 2008 studies is to see some of the progression that's happened in that period of time around alternative funding strategies and their use within the state government. Certainly, if you go to page two on the in the handout and in the document, this is not a new concept. Alternative funding approaches have been around for quite a while, going back to quite a number of years, but certainly in the early 90s, one of the last times we had a major economic downturn and setback was really where a lot of these really took off and became pretty common within state government. Certainly in the last down cycle of half a dozen years ago or more, those became even more prevalent, which is what you see in that progression from the 2003 to 2008 studies. So, why do people look at alternative funding approaches? You'll see in the pie chart in there from the Center for Digital Government from this past year, common reasons that shouldn't be any big surprise that is what everyone is grappling with, tight state budgets being 24% of the reasons people look at it, and the other primary reasons were really around need to fund large multi-agency projects that weren't going to, flow out of one funding stream, or to fund large multi-year projects that weren't going to fit within a biennium and had a long string to them. So there are a lot of reasons people look at alternative funding approaches, but bottom line, it gets down to most often large, complex projects that are really required or necessary to look at. When we're cutting costs here in the short run, what are we doing to drive and provide innovation so we're positioning ourselves for the future versus cutting now and kind of shooting ourselves in the foot as we go forward with some of the items we look at? So it's how do you get that cash, how do you get that capital in play to be able to keep those innovations moving and fund those? Next slide, and third slide, is really looking at some of the questions to make sure that I think are important to ask and look at. Anytime you're looking at IT funding, period, but also more important when you're looking at alternative funding approaches, to really know what you're getting into, to really think about, are you ready? Are your people ready for this? As we talked about in some of the previous discussions here today about disruptive change, and that this can, these are projects that take a lot of time and effort for the people, and you need to make sure that everyone's ready, that you have a clear understanding of what is the value or what is the business issue that is trying to be solved, and that can be articulated, and that's going to be very important for the funders to understand that, to be focused on the value proposition. And then, looking at have you engaged the right stakeholders, are the right people at the table as you're going through the process, and can you get the resources to pull it off both internally as well as externally, because just because you're looking at alternative funding doesn't take away a lot of the requirements for a state or any other organization to provide the leadership and key resources to make a deal happen. If you go to slide five, it summarizes really four primary funding approaches, and you'll see in the in the detailed material that's actually behind this, you could break those four areas into 10 or 15 or 20, depending on how you look at it. I just grouped them into four primary groupings, and we'll walk through each of those briefly. But Debt financing really looks at bond issuance, leasing, other common forms of debt or debt instruments. Internal service funds and user fees being a second category, third being the various forms of vendor participation, and lastly being partnerships, which include outsourcing and or managed services, which has been talked about quite a bit as we've gone through the discussion here this afternoon already. Going to slide six, debt financing, bond issuance, and leasing, you know, a couple of key points here to make, and one is, you know, we talked about the importance of a business case and any kind of in some of the previous discussions, any kind of transformation or effort you're going under. It's especially important when you're looking at bond issuance or leasing, because that business case really needs to focus the resources on the value, but also analyze and understand what is the cash flow required to pull off the deal, because the people who are going to get repaid need to know that, and obviously as an organization there has to be a great deal of attention to focus to the timing of different aspects of when things are done and what that does to the cash flow stream, and then that what that in turn does to your costs. So certainly general obligation bonds are an option that some states have looked at. Revenue bonds probably more common as you look at some of these projects or initiatives that have a payback directly from their value. And then leasing, looking at operating or capital leases where you can have a long-term lease where you give the asset back at the end of it, or a capital which is a lease with an option to purchase as you go along.
Yeah. And I've got a question here.
Yeah.
Several. The proposal that is being made by the governor for some technology here is for a 10-year lease to purchase. Do you know if other states is that within the time frame that other states look at? Is there something that makes sense or does not make sense, and how long you're going to be doing this this leasing option?
Mr. Chairman, I think a couple of things are real important when you look at it, and this gets back to the cash flow management, is trying to match, you know, whether it's bonds or a lease, either way, it's very important to try to match the length of that lease or the length of that bond with what you think the likely long-term life of that asset is. So, you know, it'd be similar if, you know, if any of us were, you know, buying a car, that we'd want to make sure that, you know, at the time that car is turned in, that we don't have 3 years left to pay on it, that actually the, you know, the life of the asset is at least as long as the life of the lease or the bond. So, you know, when you look at 10 years for a significant technology system that's not outside of the norm or reasonableness, you know, a lot of those systems will be 10 years, sometimes 15 years in length before they're ultimately turned over. Certainly there's a number of upgrades that happen during, you know, an interim period of time, but 10 years is not an unusual term.
Okay. Sir Robley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was along the same lines. We have talked about general obligation bonds, and it's been generally frowned upon here because of the life expectancy of the product.
Right.
But I saw that Massachusetts apparently used that system to finance quite a bit of their IT. Was that bond for like 10 years, or how did they go about doing it, and how did the bond houses look at it?
Mr. Dahl.
Well, thank you, the Senator and Mr. Chair. The Massachusetts is a good example of somebody who's used bonding and used it pretty effectively to fund innovation over a number of years. They've been using it for, you know, probably a decade now, and over I think over $400 million in innovation funding coming through bonds during that period of time. Your question again on looking at is that widely accepted? Certainly a lot of people use bonds, or, you know, I don't think there's a big issue with looking at bonding for technology, much like any other infrastructure. If you're bonding for a building or a road, or it's all, I think, pretty widely viewed in the investment community as these are infrastructure assets. The key aspect, again, is making sure that the life of the asset is matched up well with the bond, so that you're not issuing a 20-year bond to pay for an asset that's going to turn in 10 years. going to get yourself in a real rough spot around repayment.
So, Mr. Chair, so Massachusetts, for example, were those 10-year bonds, or what length did they have on theirs?
I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and look for you.
Okay, please proceed.
Okay. So that's some things around debt financing. And again, Massachusetts is a good example. Another one, Wyoming has used lease payment options for their data center as another example. There are a lot of good examples of this being in place, and you can see on the highlight on the bottom of the page, these are not tools used by everyone, but they are pretty commonly used tools in state government today. The next area, internal investment funds and internal user fees, these are basically pools of money that have been set aside for a variety of purposes. They often are, start with some seed capital or seed money to provide an innovation fund. Philadelphia Performance Bank, Shared Services often start in this this method. University of Minnesota has used this in the past. A lot of states use this tool to get some innovation going with some seed capital that then is a loan that's paid back internally based on value or performance on a particular project. That's on the investment fund piece of it. On the user fee part, internal user fee, again, this is really looking at often a central entity looking at being able to save money through a long-term innovation and then charging agencies based on what the understood or perceived value or saving is going to be on that. Certainly some key factors around that to be effective are having a good rate or fee charging model developed, well understood. One of the common complaints with this kind of an approach is people get in a line item, here's a X $1,000 charge to your budget from a central organization that is not well understood, maybe not agreed to, is certainly not transparent. So those are things that are important to understand and lay the groundwork up front to make sure that there is a common understanding and transparency around those rates moving forward. Also that there's some selection and oversight of the funds. How are projects determined and agreed upon for use of these funds? Is that done through an office of innovation? Is it done through a CIO's office? Is it done through another planning process to identify these projects that are taken on that will use this internal investment fund? And then lastly, it's certainly key to have oversight of those projects from a broad base of internal users, whether that would be a state group of CIOs or commissioners or other people that are impacted and both positive and negative by the outcomes of various projects. And again, this is a very, very common method for driving innovation and using funds that can pay back themselves over time. The next page, if you go to slide 8, gets to vendor participation. And vendor participation can take many forms. That's certainly people like us at Deloitte, other vendors that have been here today, and many others you're well aware of in the community offer a variety of ways to be innovative and creative in how projects are structured and paid for. That can be the most common areas, certainly around things such as benefit sharing. So getting percentage saving of a savings or a percentage of a value metric that's agreed upon by parties, performance-based based on hitting agreed-upon goals that drives whether somebody gets 60, 80, or 100% of an allocation or a project to say you're limiting output of dollars based on results. And then lastly, looking at unit charges that are often then run through some type of an external customer, such as a surcharge or various user fees, and having those collected to pay a vendor, and that vendor is then paid over often a deferred time period to cover their costs. So some key factors or key things to look at and think about in these arrangements. requires very strong leadership internally to keep these projects on track and driving forward and these arrangements in line, but also a strong history and relationship with the vendors, somebody who's got a vested interest in the long-term success or outcome of your organization, that's there, and there's kind of that proven history to work through challenges as they come up, that there is clear authority over what can and can't be done in these areas, and again, clear models for how you charge, but also how you measure benefits. So these are common mechanisms for paying for things such as integrated taxes, purchasing or e-procurement type areas, e-government. These are very common ways that those types of projects are paid for. For example, state of Iowa has used it for their e-government and innovation. Virginia has used it to pay for their procurement system. So there are a number of examples of where this has been very well, well approved and executed. Another key factor in this, though, is a clear understanding, well-defined contracts with clear performance measurements understood, and when and how people will get paid understood. And this gets back to where often those types of projects, especially ones that are paid for on a percentage of savings, where those often go awry or break down, is if there isn't that clear understanding up front and in the contract on how benefits are measured. Where somebody might look at a baseline and say, I think we saved $5 million, another person might look at it and say they saved $10 million. And if that hasn't been clearly understood and documented and contracted up front, that's where some of these contracts tend to go awry. And again, this is not used by everyone all in the states, but again, very common tool. The last grouping or last area to talk a little bit about is partnerships. Partnerships can be public-private, public-public, and can be outsourcing, which is really a form of a public-private. So what are things to think about here? Well, one is that, again, the contract development and defining options. What are your exit clauses? What happens if things don't work out? You heard some discussion of that in the previous presentations today, but again, those are very important to have that knowledge and understanding that the procurement has gone through a process that brings in best practices for these types of arrangements, because they can be very complex and not your standard contracts to deal with. That there's a clear training, communication, stakeholder management that occurs throughout these, and risk management, governance become very critical as you move forward on these those types of arrangements, because again, you have taken some control that you have over an operation and given it to somebody else. So understanding how that's going to work, how you're going to manage your risk, and making sure that those are defined in the contracts and in the procurement process are very important. And lastly, that what a change that happens with some of the skill set, often of internal people that are involved, is rather than being a contract manager, when they're looking at a lot of these services, they become a relationship manager. So there's often a much different skill set from the senior executives in trying to manage these relationships effectively going over time as a relationship management versus just a contract management. Examples of outsourcing and public private are things you've already heard quite a bit about today, so I won't go into those. And public-public, these are things like you see with TIES, which provides technology services to over 38 districts around the state, everything from ERP, student services, portal development, training, so forth. There's a lot of great ways that those public-public partnerships can be put in place. That's one example. Another is LOGIS, which is an entity that serves more than 20 local government units, again, with providing services and shared systems, things like ERP and GIS, fleet management, utility billing, 911. So there are a lot of ways that things can be pooled together, services can be shared, technologies can be shared. Matter of fact, another common form of, I'll call it public-public, is an insourcing arrangement rather than outsourcing, where you're looking at an organization like OET insourcing operations from various agencies that happen to be more utility-based or utility-type functions, but also potentially insourcing services in a public partnership for other state organizations such as the university system or vice versa, or working with cities, counties, and other forms of government. So that is the fourth kind of key model, and some thoughts around that, some experience. The next two slides, which are the last two I wanted to hit on here briefly, are some lessons learned on conducting first on benefits measurement and savings validation. We talked about in each one of these models how important it is to understand where you are and where you're going, have that in a clear business case, and measure that in a way that is well understood. So what are some of the things you need to do? I've got 10 listed here, but I'll just cover a couple of them. First is to have establish a clear baseline that is well understood. Secondly, to share that broadly so it's communicated and you don't have a number of surprises later, that there's an understanding of what's included as a savings and what's not. So, for example, what do you do with cost avoidance? Is that a savings for the business case or not? And there's different opinions that float around all those different types of savings categories, and the important part is that everyone has a common understanding of what will be counted up front, and that then those measurements are based on facts and data that are gathered and analyzed over time. And lastly, that the benefits savings is not just on dollars and cents, because often what you're trying to accomplish are things like improved access, greater security, improve quality of data or service, and so the value on investment is very important to capture beyond just the hard dollars and cents. The last point is on the lessons learned. We've got a number of them listed here. A couple, again, I'll point out that are crucial to any of these types of arrangements. First is that you have strong leadership. That leadership is focused and using the business case, kind of living in a defined business case, that they're using to focus the efforts of themselves and the project over time, that a big vision or picture is in place of what the value is you're ultimately trying to get to, but things are taken one step at a time, and transformation one step at a time, and that in today's world, with the obstacles that we're trying to overcome, from the current economic mandate for change, that those steps have to be very fast to really help accomplish what needs to happen. But also that the next group of lessons are around making sure there's strong project management and an understanding or attention to what are the barriers for change, and those are being addressed. And lastly, that there is good focus placed on communication and training of the workforce. Often where these deals fall down at the end of the day is if the workforce that's going to carry forward the new technology or new project into the future hasn't been effectively trained, the benefits that are achieved initially snap back and lose their value going forward. So that training piece, developing the staff, is really crucial.
Well, thank you, Mr. Dell. Again, until we have a specific proposal before us, it's kind of hard to make any cost analysis, but I think you've at least given us some issues to look at if and when we get to that point. Are there any questions, Mr. Dell, here today? Appears to be none. Well, thank you for coming here today and providing us some background information.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
And like these issues do have some concerns, and of course I recognize that even putting it on the agenda would raise some issues. Again, there's no proposal before us, but MAPE wanted to be heard on this issue. So welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Richard Kajewski. I am the Legislative Affairs Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. In my capacity, I represent nearly 12,500 state professional degree non-supervisory employees, including all of the information technology ones, twos, threes, fours, and fives in state government. I have no experience in IT. I'll be the first one to admit it, but prior to this, I was a business rep, and I did have OET on my account list, so I learned maybe a thing or two. But I won't lay claim to anything more than that. Although I have spoken to former Minneapolis employees, former Unisys employees, and current OET employees, it's with regret that I inform you that none of them were willing to testify today out of fear of retaliation. MAPE has a major concern in the governor's budget. His budget contains about $16.5 million in appropriations to assist state agencies to make the transition to a consolidated data center operation. $2.91 million was for migration and consolidation of servers, and the remaining $12.235 million is to lease new data center space and facility management from an outside provider. When it comes to alternative funding for IT, I think there's many factors that we have to take into consideration. We heard from the city of Minneapolis today. Some of the information I got was a little different. I was informed that the city of Minneapolis, who does outsource the majority of their IT work, as we heard, has to write a work ticket anytime they want anything done to the tune of $220. Then Unisys or the outsourced company bills for the completed work. Moving a computer from one desk to another in the city of Minneapolis costs approximately $400. The city of Minneapolis recently had Java 1.6 loaded onto a block of computers to the cost of $15,000 taxpayer dollars. Now, that may not seem like much to you and I, but Java 1.6, even I can get off the internet and load onto my computer. It's free software. The problem with this outsourced arrangement really is that Minneapolis doesn't own their own computers, Unisys, or their own equipment. Unisys even outsources some of Minneapolis's work to another individual vendor who goes to Minneapolis to do it. Once an initial contract is up, you're on the hook with no equipment to the renewal of a contract and charges at a much higher rate. You've lost control at that point. Outsourcing data center space in this state as well and consolidated service will cost the state of Minnesota customer service that they now benefit from. Now you can call the Office of Enterprise Technology, speak to an employee handling your account, and handle your issues over the telephone. They can get remote access to deal with your issue, and they can walk through the tunnel down here to assist you. You can easily call down there and find out when they will get to the issue that you have. One thing we didn't hear today is how much time and wasted money is spent in government who've outsourced waiting for something to get fixed that an employee is prevented from working on. Outsourcing will result in ticket writing. It will result on a first-come, first-served basis, and some of this is done in Minsky already. Additionally, it will likely require travel from a distant location while the employee may be prevented from doing work. The computer moved at the rate of $400 can take, from the stories I've heard, upwards to towards 3 weeks. There's been concerns in the city of Minneapolis with fixing computers inside law enforcement vehicles. But perhaps the most concerning issue to me and most of the people I speak to is sending this data to a non-governmental resource. The state of Minnesota maintains data centers and servers that contain BCA data. The state maintains servers and data centers that hold DHS-related benefit payments, the state's data network, Department of Health, Corrections, the Attorney General information, and even public safety data. They hold data for every single sheriff's department in the state of Minnesota. They store data for the criminal justice information system used by law enforcement and corrections. Is this the data we really want entrusted somewhere else outside of state government? Members, I assure you that MAPE supports efficiency in state government. We brought forward an agenda that points out many efficiencies in state government that can be accomplished this session, to leadership, to committee chairs. Some of it's been acted on. But I can also assure you that OET has not had a major failure in 10 years that I can track. They do disaster recovery drills regularly, including with connections out on the East Coast. They have a disaster recovery plan. They have cameras and video recording in their major data centers. Minnesota has commercial-grade power and cooling in their major data centers. And at the same time, I can assure you that some of the small boards and agencies might be able to benefit from consolidation in space available at the Office of Enterprise Technology. Minnesota runs an efficient operation today. Now, I would suggest to you that a lot of the testimony today surrounds the $12.235 million in lease space that the governor's proposing. But the Office of Enterprise Technology put forth an agency narrative with their budget through the governor's office that was done through an assessment that was completed by Unisys in state government, the same company that does the outsourcing for the city of Minneapolis. And in that, when you talk about risk of security, wires behind all these servers, all twisted up, proper heating and cooling, and security camera and recording equipment, which all are alleged in there to not exist in state government today, I can assure you that's the furthest from the truth. There has not been a single crash in a data center that's alleged in that document that's being kept confidential for whatever reason. I can assure you they predict there will be data center crashes 3 to 5 in the next 3 years. I can assure you we haven't had one in 10 years. And I suspect that we won't have one in another 10. I just wanted to make one more comment. Senator Limmer referenced or asked the city of Minneapolis about their engagement with labor when this process was going on. I can assure you we have meet and confers regularly at the Office of Enterprise Technology. It's been the state CIO's choice not to be present or have upper management present. They instead are represented by human resource managers. But I can assure you those meetings go on, and I can assure you we've never had discussions. The ITS 1s, 2s, 3s, 4s, and 5s in state government today have not been a part of any of this process. And I would encourage those people who are moving on this process already to start involving labor. Having said that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kajewski. Any questions of him? There being none, thank you very much. Okay, that will conclude today's meeting. We are going to be meeting on Monday. We'll be here from the Department of Administration. Okay? See you then. Bye.